a great pleasure to be in this wonderful new facility. I wonder whether you like to maybe some whether it's visible. Is this okay over there? Okay. So I'd like to tell you about the Grobner bases, the joy of solving equations. And what are Grobner bases? So Grobner bases are a method for computing with polynomials and several variables. And they generalize three very classical methods, which you might have seen, most of you will have seen. So first of all, there's Gaussian elimination for solving linear systems of algebraic equations. Then there's the Euclidean algorithm. The Euclidean algorithm calculates the GCD, or greatest common divisor. Well, it does so for integers, but it also does that for polynomials in one variable, and it's in the latter guise that we're going to use that. And finally, a little bit less classical, maybe 60 years old, is the simplex algorithm for linear programming for solving linear systems of inequalities. And wouldn't it be nice if there were a common generalization of all of these methods? Well, then the answer is there is, and that's the topic of the lecture tonight. So let's review, sort of, before we go to these examples, let me tell you the general setup. So the general setup of Grobner bases is that you have a bunch of polynomials, the Brown input polynomials. I'm going to call them F1 up to Fn. So these are polynomials and a bunch of unknowns, and they're going to be Brown, and then they're going to be the input. And then there's a method called the Buchberger's algorithm that takes these input polynomials and produces a new list of polynomials, G1 up to Gm. They're going to be blue tonight, and they will be the output polynomials. Now, of course, you know, there should be some advantage of having the blue output G over having the brown input F. I mean, any algorithm, any computation, the reason you do it is that the output should somehow reveal more than the input. And that's going to be the case here, too. Namely, we're going to answer questions about the brown input polynomials F by looking at the blue output polynomials G. So that's the general idea. So we have a black box that eats a bunch of polynomials, it makes some other polynomials, and we're going to answer questions about the input polynomials by looking at the output polynomials. So let's see how this works for Gaussian elimination. So let's look at a system of two linear equations and three unknowns, x, y, and z. Well, what you do, you know, in linear algebra is you replace these equations, you solve, for instance, you express x and y in terms of z. And you see, in this case, x is z minus 14, y is 11 minus twice z. And the output is better than the input, right? The output reveals information. It tells you that the solution set to this system is a line in three-dimensional space. And it gives you a parametric representation of all the points on the line. So you've solved the equation. Let me rewrite this example in the brown-blue input-output notation. So I can take the linear input equations. I can rewrite this as 2x plus 3y plus 4z minus 5. I bring this to the other side. So I have these two brown input linear polynomials. And then I run my black box called Gaussian elimination. And I produce two output linear polynomials. And here they are, x minus z plus 14, y plus 2z minus 11. I also underline the leading terms here, and I can think about G as expressing the solution. So X and Y have been expressed in terms of Z, and there are lots and lots and lots of seats up here. Okay, so that's Gaussian elimination. Let's review the Euclidean algorithm. So the Euclidean algorithm computes the GCD, the greatest common divisor. And as I said, we're going to do this here for polynomials in one variable. So let's take this Brown polynomial F1 of degree 4. And here's a second Brown polynomial F2 of degree 5. And I've chosen these two polynomials that they share two common roots, namely plus 1 and plus 2. And so the greatest common divisor is exactly this one, x squared minus 3x plus 2. And there's some algorithm called the Euclidean algorithm that eats the two Brown input polynomials, performs some steps,
and makes the blue output polynomial.
Now again, in our Grobner basis notation, we can think about Brown F to be the set of these two input polynomials, and the output G is the singleton, the set consisting of the single output polynomial, the GCD. So maybe we can think about, we will think about Grobner bases tonight as a kind of Euclidean algorithm for polynomials in more than one variable. Or, alternatively, as a kind of Gaussian elimination for nonlinear algebraic equations. Let me come to the third classical algorithm, perhaps a little bit less familiar in the standard math curriculum. Everybody learns about Gaussian elimination and Euclidean algorithm, but perhaps not everybody learns about the simplex algorithm. So let's look at the following optimization problem. We have four unknowns, capital P, N, D, and Q. And I'd like to minimize the sum of these unknowns, the linear function P plus N plus D plus Q, subject to two constraints, three constraints really. I want these unknowns to be non-negative, I want them to be integer, and I want them to satisfy a linear equation. And the linear equation I chose here is P plus 5N plus 10D plus 25Q is 170. If you think about this for a moment, so it turns out that this has a unique solution, and the unique solution is this one. P is 2, you know, N is 1, D is 1, and Q is 4. So the unique optimal solution, so the optimal value of the objective function is 8. Now in English, this is of course a coin problem. So in English, you have a portfolio in your pocket. So in the abstract, the very short abstract to this talk, the question is, what should you do with the coins in your pocket? Well, you should optimize that portfolio. So you have a bunch of coins in your pocket, and you have a certain number, capital P of pennies, N of nickels, D of dimes, and Q of quarters. And let's call that the portfolio. And this is a very simple optimization problem. It says you would like to replace the coins in your pocket by some other set of coins, which has the same monetary value, here $1.17, but uses the fewest coins as possible. So the question in English, what this says is, what's the fewest number of coins you need to make $1.17? And the answer is 8. And the unique solution is 2 pennies, 1 nickel, 1 dime, and 4 quarters. Now this also can be phrased in the Grobner basis language, and the way this works is as follows. So we think of a particular collection of coins or portfolio. We're going to represent that by a monomial in lowercase variables, P, N, D, and Q. So P to the A, N to the B, D to the C, and Q to the D, bad notation, represents the bag of coins with A pennies, B nickels, C dimes, and D quarters. So for instance, if I write something like this, P, when I say in my pocket I have P squared D to the fourth, I mean I carry 14 cents. No, that's not true. I carry 42 cents, and these are 2 pennies and 4 dimes. Okay. So now we're ready to formulate the Brown input polynomials and blue output polynomials. So the Brown input polynomials is a system of monomial differences or binomials that represent the monetary value, the relative value of the coins. So here's P to the fifth minus N. It says 5 pennies make a nickel. P to the 10 minus D. And P to the 25th minus Q. 25 pennies makes a quarter. So now I run my algorithm, I transform this, and out comes some other set of equations, of polynomials. And here they are, P to the fifth minus N, we knew that. Here's a new one, N squared minus D. 2 nickels make a dime, so somehow the algorithm derived that. D squared N minus Q, 2 dimes and nickel is the same as a quarter. And finally, D cubed minus N cubed are the two ways of expressing 30 cents. Now, the way we're going to read this, we're going to read these relations from left to right, and we're going to think about them as replacement rules. So
So what you should do with the coins in your pocket, you should successively apply these replacement rules in any way, in any order you want. So this rule says, whenever you find 5 pennies in your pocket, trade them in for a nickel. Whenever you find 2 nickels, you replace them by a dime. If you have 2 dimes and a nickel, you trade it in for a quarter. And finally, if you find 3 dimes, you can trade it in for a nickel and a quarter. And you're allowed to do this until you get stuck. Now, why is this a good thing to do? Well, that decreases your objective function. Each of these steps decreases the number of coins in your pocket, but it maintains the monetary value. So it gets you closer and closer to your goal. So let's see how this goes in an example. So what should you do? Well, you reply this. So given a collection of coins, you replace, you use the rules encoded by the blue output set to transform in any order, any way you want, the input collection into an output portfolio with equal monetary value but smaller number of elements. So for instance, let's say at the beginning in our example we have $1.17, 5 dimes, 10 nickels, 17 pennies. So I first apply the first rule. So I take 5 of my pennies and replace them by a nickel. So now I'm down to P to the 12th, N to the 11th, D to the 5th. I do it 2 more times. And now I'm down here. I'm down to 20 coins, right? P squared, N to the 13th, D to the 5th. So now I can no longer replace 5 pennies by a nickel. Unlike the federal government, we're not allowed to use negative integers, exponents here. So the way we do this now we have to, replace one of these, take one of these other rules. So one of the other rules was we can have N squared D minus Q. So we do that. We pick up a quarter. We do it again. 2 nickels and a dime makes a quarter, and so on and so on. And eventually we get stuck. So we're here. We're stuck at P squared N D Q to the 4th. So now we've reached a local optimum, right? We apply these rules and we get stuck and we can no longer approve. So I claim that that's actually a global optimum, that this amazing blue set of polynomials, G, called the Grubner basis, has the property, and that's the defining property, that no matter what bag of coins you start with, and no matter in which order you apply these rules, once you're stuck, then you are actually at the optimal solution. So let's see. So what is a Grubner basis in this context? So this context is called integer programming. So Grubner bases give a method of transforming a feasible solution using local moves, such as n squared d minus q, using local moves into a global optimum. And if you're familiar with the simplex algorithm for linear programming, this is very analogous. So in the simplex algorithm, you go from feasible basis to feasible basis to feasible basis until you're stuck, until you can no longer improve. And then there's some magic called convexity that guarantees that if you're stuck, then you're actually globally optimal. And here there's some similar magic that guarantees that once we're stuck, we have the global optimum. Now, before I get to the general theory, of course, there's a little bit of a challenge. I mean, the difficulty here is to find the blue set. So you have to actually go from here to here. So the difficulty is to find the minimal set of moves that has this amazing property. And you can try this, So for different values, imagine you travel to a different country that uses a different monetary system. For instance, Hogwarts. So if you travel, you go with Harry Potter to Hogwarts, then they use a different monetary system, right? So they have, one galleon, right, is 17 sickles, and one sickle is 29 knuts, and then you put that in, that's going to be your brown input set, you redo the computation, and then you get a finite list of moves, blue G, that will work at Hogwarts. So that's the basic idea. So now we're ready for the general theory. And that would be a very good moment to ask for a question. So maybe I can invite our youngest participant. Is that clear? Did you read Harry Potter?
Yeah.
Okay, the new movie is coming out very soon.
And one more book, actually. We're all looking forward to that. Any other questions?
You keep saying polynomials with several variables, but not a lot of variables. Do things get more complicated when you have lots of variables?
Everything in life gets more complicated. So, yes.
I remember vaguely for Gaussian elimination and Euclidean algorithms, there's this whole theory of complexity, how many steps it takes in terms of powers of n. Are you going to do that for us also?
Not tonight.
It exists.
Yeah, there is a theory, and it's so I'd rather not say a lot about the complexity. So there's some studies, not enough, more should be done. The asymptotic worst case complexity of what I'm describing is terrible, but it turns out that for many cases of interest, it's actually not so bad. So that's roughly the situation. So computer scientists hate Grobner bases because the asymptotic worst-case complexity is very, very bad. But you know, mathematicians, unlike computer scientists, actually like to compute, and so for us, they're pretty. For us, it's pretty good. Okay. So now the theory.
Okay. I hope I'm trying to be Doron Salberg. offend as many people as possible. Okay. So here's the setting. So let me write Q, x1 up to xn is the set of polynomials in x, the ring of polynomials in n unknowns, x1 up to xn. And for the coefficients of my polynomials, I'm going to take the rational numbers. Q is the rational numbers. And Brown F is any set of polynomials with rational coefficients. Now, I like the rational numbers because I can actually write them down. So I can take a rational number and communicate them to my computer. So along those lines, I don't believe in the real numbers or the complex numbers. I mean, they're nice to think. It's nice to think about real numbers. It's very nice to think about complex numbers, but you can't sort of write them down, right? And you can't communicate them to your computer. So that's why we're going to take the rational numbers as our coefficients when we write down these polynomials. Now, if we have this bag of polynomials F, we're going to look at the ideal generated by F. And this is the set of all polynomial linear combinations of the elements in F. So the ideal bracket F is the set of all new polynomials, P1 F1 plus P2 F2 plus 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 PR FR, where the FI are Brown input polynomials and the multipliers PI are any other polynomial. And that's called the ideal generated by F. It's the first concept. So, well, it turns out that in each of the examples we have seen, the brown input polynomials and the blue output polynomials, they look very different, right? Blue is better than brown, but they are equivalent. They describe the equivalent. They are equivalent in the sense that they generate the same ideal. So in the Gaussian elimination example, in the Euclidean algorithm example, and in the coin example, the input polynomials generate an ideal, and as an ideal, that's exactly the same as the ideal of the output polynomial. So what that means, in each of these three cases, each brown polynomial is a linear combination of the blue polynomials, and conversely, every blue polynomial is a linear combination of the brown polynomials. But, you know, somehow blue is better than brown. Now, if you did take an algebra class in your undergraduate days, you might remember that polynomials in one variable are a principal ideal domain. That means in one variable, every ideal is generated by a single polynomial. So here we have some ideal, but in one variable, there's only always a single generator, and the algorithm that finds that generator is called the Euclidean algorithm. So in each of these examples, they generate the same ideal, but somehow a blue G is better than brown F because it reveals more structure. It tells us the dimension of the solution space, how many common roots there are, how to trade coins, and so on. Now the next thing you need to do when you write down a polynomial, let's pretend you write down a polynomial, and well, usually what you do is you write the highest term, right? And then you write the second highest term and the third highest term and so on. Right? That's how you write a polynomial.
But in order to do that, you need a rule that tells you who is the highest term. Now that's pretty obvious in one variable, but it's no longer so obvious in two and more variables. So we need the notion of a term order. So a term order is a total ordering of all the monomials. So a monomial is x1 to the a1, x2 to the a2, up to xn to the an. In shorthand, x to the a, where the a's are non-negative integers. And I would like my total order to satisfy two properties. First of all, I want the monomial 1. So 1 is x to the 0. Okay? So the 1 monomial, also known as x to, that I want to be the smallest. So that the constants always go last. So first you write the non-constant stuff, but the constant is the smallest monomial. And the second rule is that the ordering is multiplicative. Okay, so, you know, that says, so let's say the three of us are monomials, and Keith is bigger than me, and we both get multiplied by Burke, then that relationship is still the case. Okay, so if x to the a is less than x to the b, and we both get multiplied by x to the c, then the order stays the same. So those are the two axioms that I like to ensure. Now let's think about this for a moment. So for instance, in one variable, let's say in one variable. Now that uniquely specifies the ordering, right? Because 1 is the smallest monomial, and 1 is less than x. Okay, so here's 1, here's x. Okay, so now we multiply by x. Then x is less than x squared. Okay, let's do it again. So x squared is less than x, and so on. Okay, so in one variable that uniquely specifies the ordering, but in two and more variables, there are actually many, 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 uncountably many. For those of you who believe in the real numbers, uncountably many term orders, you know, that you could choose. So here are two examples, and those are the only examples I'm going to refer to. So here's the purely lexicographic order. Let's do the second first. So the purely lexicographic order, it says the following. So first you list all the monomials in x1. Those are the smallest. 1 is less than x1. Da, da, da. Okay. And then when you're done with all infinitely many monomials in x1, then comes x2. And then you go like that. Okay. So in the lexicographic order, the higher variables, they are so expensive, they're going to carry the cake. And they're going to really, you know, win. Okay? That's exactly how we order words in the English dictionary, or the German, for that matter. Right? So in the dictionary, the pure lexicographic order is the dictionary order. So in the dictionary, the way this goes, you know, all the words that start with A come before the words that start with B, regardless how long they are. Right? So that's the dictionary order on monomials. On the other hand, you could also take the so-called degree lexicographic order. So in the degree lexicographic order, well, you first partially order the monomials. You first sort them by total degree. So you first take 1, then the linear monomials, then the quadratics, then the cubics, and then within each group, you break ties lexicographically. So that's the degree lexicographic order. Now, this is not usually how we do it in the dictionary. But you could imagine doing it like this. And imagine a dictionary, right, where we first list the short words, right, and then the longer words, and then the really long words, and then the German nouns. So that's sort of one way to do it. And then if you have two words of the same length, then you use the usual dictionary. Now, that's not usually done by us. But that is done by people who analyze biological sequence data. So motifs in computational biology, usually the dictionary, so if you have a four-letter alphabet, and I could go on all night about that, and they usually use that order. Okay. Anyway, so this is the degree lexicographic order and the purely lexicographic order. Now, once we agree on the ordering of the monomials, then every polynomial has a unique leading monomial, or initial monomial. So the initial monomial, which I'm going to call in sub f, well, that would depend on the term order we agreed on. So we fix a term order, and then the initial monomial in f is the largest monomial in the order that appears with non-zero coefficient in the expansion of the polynomial. That's the highest guy.
polynomial definition. Okay, now we can do the same thing for ideals. Take a breath. So I is now an ideal in the polynomial ring, x1 up to xn. And I'm going to define the initial ideal of I to be the ideal generated by all the initial monomials of polynomials in I. So I'm going to write in sub I, and that's an ideal, okay? And it's generated by all infinitely many monomials that I get by taking all infinitely many polynomials f in the ideal. Okay? That's called the initial. So let's say three polynomials walk into the room and they together generate an ideal. What's their initial ideal? Right? The initial ideal is the following. We need to take a look at all infinitely many linear combinations of these three guys. It's not enough to take the three leading monomials of the three fellows that walked in, but we have to take all possible linear combinations that we can dream up, look at the initial monomials, and they together generate an ideal, and that's called the initial ideal. Now, people who study differential equations, I mean, this comes in many words. So differential equation is called the symbol of the differential operators, and so on. So basically, you have a bunch of equations, and you look at the leading stuff of everything that's implied by the given equations. That's called the initial ideal.
We have until 7:30?
Yes.
Okay, so I have 31 and a half minutes left. Okay, definition.
So now we're ready to define a Grothendieck analysis. A finite subset, blue G, of a given ideal I is called a Grothendieck basis. Relative to the term order we agreed on, if the finitely many blue leading monomials coming from blue G are good enough to generate all infinitely many monomials. That is to say, if the initial ideal in of I is already generated by the monomials, leading monomials coming from blue G. So that's the definition. Okay. So again, these three guys, these three polynomials, walk into the door, you know. So a Grothendieck basis would be maybe seven linear combinations of these guys, such that if you look at those seven leading terms, then no matter what other linear combination you take, that additional leading term won't contribute if it will already be divisible by one of those leading terms. So that's the definition of a Grothendieck. Now, this many comments are needed. First of all, this tells us nothing about how we could ever compute a Grothendieck basis, right? This is completely inconstructive. First of all, the term basis is very, very misleading, right? Because the way I've described this here, this is not unique. I mean, and also, you know, we can, once we have this property, we can throw in more elements and it's still the still satisfied. So it would be actually better to call this a Grothendieck generating set. Because if you think about bases in mathematics, well, you think of something that spans something, and it's sort of minimal. But there's no minimality at all in this definition. So unfortunately, for historic reasons, this is called a basis. This is sort of defined as a basis, but really this is sort of a generating set, a Grothendieck generating set. So how can we make this minimal? That happens on the next slide. So to make this minimal, there's a notion of reduced Grothendieck basis, and here's the definition. So for a reduced Grothendieck basis, you have three additional requirements, and the first two are sort of very easy, and the third is a little bit more tricky. So the first one says, well, you know, we want the coefficients, we want all the polynomials to be monic. I want to make the leading coefficients to be one. That's easy to do, right? You have some polynomial, you just divide by the leading. The second thing you want is that the set of leading monomials in your Grothendieck basis minimally generates the initial ideal. Well, that's easy to do. You just throw out those guys that don't contribute, right? So you have, you know, 11 leading monomials, and, you know, one guy is divisible by another one, then you throw the first polynomial out. No, never to be looked at. That's easy. Now, the third one is a little bit slightly more tricky. It says no trailing term of anything that you see in blue is divisible by some other leading term. So it's not in the initial eight. Okay, so these 11 guys, and they want to be a Grobner basis. Okay, you are a Grobner basis. They want to be a reduced Grobner basis. Okay, so I look at their leading terms, and here's a leading term. Okay, and somewhere else, there's a trailing term. And that trailing, which is a non-leading term, but the trailing term is divisible by somebody else's leading term. Okay, what do? You apply the division algorithm. Right, you sort of take, you know, this trailing term, you take this leading term, you multiply it up, and then you subtract, and then you keep going. Okay, so you can do this until you're satisfying these three things, and here's a theorem. That actually makes it unique. So theorem, for any ideal I in the polynomial ring, and any fixed term order, there's a unique reduced Grobner basis for this idea. So now it's unique. And that's, in fact, what the computer will do for you. Tonight, when you go home, you type in Brown input polynomials into your computer, you hit the button, and you say Grobner, and you hit return, and back comes the reduced Grobner basis. So that was what the computer will spit out for you. The computer will produce the reduced Grobner basis for you, for your given input polynomials, and that was the case in our Gaussian elimination example, that was the case in our Euclidean algorithm example, and that was the case in our count coin example. In all three examples, the output was the reduced Grobner basis for the input polynomials. All in the same order?
No. So let's look at these examples. In one variable, there's no choice. There's only one order. Well, in the Gaussian elimination example, well, the only freedom that you have is you can choose the ordering of the variables. Now, that could make a difference, right? I mean, there's a whole, you know, there's a subject called numerical linear algebra that sort of deals with how to do this the right way. But so there is, you know, a choice of ordering the variables. And here it's actually even more interesting. Here, the monomial order reflects the objective function. So here I'm using total degree, the total degree order. So here, let me say it differently. So the only freedom that you have, so tonight, you go to your computer, you type in these Brown polynomials. Okay, that's it, they're given to you. But then you have a freedom to choose the term order.
But that's actually good news, because that's the modeling power that you have. You get to pick the term order. And different term orders will have different properties and different features. So this empowers you to make the reduced Grobner basis have certain properties that you want. And here, in this sort of optimization examples, you use a term order that reflects the objective function.
Okay, there's the definition, and there's algebraic geometry. So let's do some geometry.
Let's use these ideas to study geometric objects. Well, what's algebraic geometry? Algebraic geometry is the study of zero sets of polynomial equations, solution sets to polynomial equations, and they might look like this. The surface up there is the picture, the zero set of a polynomial. So let's define this. So we need to define what in geometry is called a variety. So F is any set of polynomials, and I'm going to say the variety of F is the set of all vectors of length n, z1 up to zn, such that all Brown polynomials vanish on those vectors. So these are the common zeros in n-dimensional space of the given polynomials. We call that the variety of F, it's denoted V of F. Now here, the coordinates of the zi are allowed to be complex numbers. Aha! The speaker doesn't believe complex numbers. How come we take the complex numbers here? Well, that's true. The speaker cannot communicate or write down complex numbers, but the speaker can think about complex numbers. So here, I'm never actually going to write them down, but if I'm speaking about the variety, I'm going to use real numbers and complex numbers and so on. And it's essential here that the variety is defined over the complex numbers. Well, we want at least the real numbers to have some kind of continuity. We have the idea that this is sort of some real continuous shape, you know. But actually using the real numbers is much, much, much too hard. That's why we use the complex numbers. So the reason why algebraic geometers prefer the complex numbers rather than the real numbers is because, you know, polynomials in one variable always have a root. An algebraically closed field. So the complex numbers are much, 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 much easier than the real numbers. And hey, it's late in the night, you want to do it easy. Okay? Now the next observation is the following. So the variety actually doesn't depend on those three polynomials that came in the door. You could take any other generators of the same ideal and they would still give us the same variety. So I claim V of I depends only on the ideal generated by F. In particular, if G is a Grubner basis for the ideal, the stuff that comes out of your computer tonight, that will generate the same ideal, and therefore they will have identical varieties. Well, that was the case in the Gauss elimination example, which was a line. That was the case in the Euclidean algorithm example. And that was the case in the coin example. Now, why is it true? Think about it. So we have two bunches of polynomials, and they generate the same ideal, and I claim then they give the same variety. Okay, well, so here's the blue polynomials, there's the brown polynomials. Okay, now every brown polynomial is a linear combination of the blue polynomial. So it vanishes wherever these guys vanish. Right, so all of these guys vanish whenever these guys vanish. And conversely, so therefore they have the same vanishing set.
Okay. So that's algebraic geometry in a nutshell. Okay, so was this guy Hilbert? That's one of the long nouns.
So the Nullsternsatz is the theorem of zeros that was proved 117 years ago by David Hilbert. And he proved the following theorem. He didn't quite phrase it like this, but that's the theorem, okay? The variety is the empty set, if and only if the reduced Grubner basis that you will see tonight on your screen consists of a single polynomial, namely one. Okay, no matter what, you know, well, that's a pretty good statement, right? So let me paraphrase that. You have a friend in engineering, and that person has a system of algebraic equations, Brown equations. They say, hey, you're a mathematician. I wonder whether my equations have a solution at all. Say, complex solution. No problem. You know, we're going to take those Brown equations, type them in. We say Grubner, any term order. And if you see one on the screen, well, sure, there's no solution, right? Why is that? Well, you know, if the reduced Grubner basis is 1, you know, then the variety of F is the same as the variety of G. But the variety of G, well, that's, you know, that's the variety of the one polynomial. That's the set of all points where the one polynomial vanishes. But the one polynomial doesn't vanish at all, ever, anywhere. So that's the empty set. Okay, so the if direction is very easy. So the power of this theorem, Hilbert was a good guy. So the power of this theorem is the converse, right? That if your engineering friends equations have no solution, then necessarily this will happen. Then the Grubner basis will exhibit the one polynomial in the end. And that's the Nullsternsatz. Example, so let's say, you know, we have three equations and two variables like this, x squared plus xy minus 10, blah, 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 and then this one minus 70. You type this in, hit the button, back comes g is 1. So there are no common solutions. On the other hand, for instance, if we take, you know, this is very sensitive, if we replace this 25 by 26, we redo it, then the reduced Grubner basis comes back, x minus 2, y minus 3. So at that point, what came back is not 1. So there must be some solution. Now you can ask the question, what is the solution? Well, whatever it is, right, the variety of f is the same as the variety of that. But the variety of that, that's in this example easy to see, is a single point with coordinates 2, 3. So that's the Nullstellensatz of the theorem of the zeros. Okay. So that way you can decide quickly, modulo the complexity discussion we had, whether a system of equations has a solution. Okay, now you try this with the example that your engineering friend gives you, and the answer doesn't come back one. It comes back with blue stuff. You go back to your friend and say, hey, your equations do have solutions. What's he going to ask?
What are they?
Okay, some people said, what are they? And some people said, how many?
So let's see. Let's see how this continues. So let's do the how many first.
And then maybe we'll comment on the what are they afterwards. So to speak about the how many, we need one more notion. That's the standard monomials. So again, the same setting. I is an ideal. We fix a term order. I'm going to say a monomial is standard, is a standard monomial, if it's not in the initial ideal. If it's not divisible by any leading monomial of any leading term of anything in the ideal, then I'm going to call that a standard monomial.
Why? What's the reason for name?
I'll say in a second. Yeah, I'll come back to that. So let's just look at, just to familiarize ourselves with the notion. Well, maybe I'll answer it first. So for those, you know, who remember their undergraduate abstract algebra with fond memories, so one thing you do with an ideal, you take a quotient ring. So ideal to ring is like normal subgroup to group. Okay. So the standard monomials form a vector space basis for the residue ring. So that's what we call standard monomials. Okay, example. So let's say we're in three variables. N is three variables. And let's say, you know, we did one of these calculations tonight on your screen. The leading terms are x1 cubed, x2 to the fourth, x3 to the fifth. So how many standard monomials are there? Well, I claim that if those are the leading terms, there are 60 standard monomials. Remember, a standard monomial is a monomial not in the ideal. Right? So it's a monomial x to the something, x1 to the something, times x2 to the something, times x3 to the something, which is not divisible by this or that or that. So that means the first something is at most 2, the second something is at most 3, and the last something is at most 4. And there are 60 choices, right? 3 times 4 times 5. So in this case, there's 60 standard monomials. On the other hand, if the Grubner basis comes back, so let's say this guy gets replaced by x1, x3 to the fourth, then the number of standard monomials is infinite. Right? It could happen, and usually does happen, often happens, that the number of standard monomials is infinite. So here, right, every power of x3 is standard. So if you take x3 raised to a million, it's not divisible by any of these. And then you try, you know, x3 raised to a billion, still not divisible for any of these, and so on. So there are infinitely many standard monomials. In the first case, there are finitely many sixth standard monomials. The second, there are, you know, infinite. Okay, theorem. So the question was, how many solutions are there? Well, that's called the fundamental theorem of algebra. The fundamental theorem of algebra says the number of zeros. So if you want to count the solutions to your equations, and you have to count them with multiplicity, is equal to the number of standard monomials. The cardinality of the variety, the number of solutions of the equations, equals the number of standard monomials. Period. That's okay. So your engineering friend, you count the number of standard monomials, you say 60. The answer is 60. There are going to be 60 solutions. Now, this is crazy. The speaker must be crazy, right? This is not the fundamental theorem of algebra I remember. Sure, it's the fundamental theorem of algebra that you remember. So what is the fundamental theorem? The fundamental theorem of algebra that you remember is this statement in one variable, right? In one variable, it's a principal ideal domain. Every ideal is principal. So it's generated by a single polynomial, say, of degree n. So the Grubner base, the leading one, the, you know, the leading ideal is x to the n. The standard monomials are 1, x, x squared, x cubed, or x to the n minus 1. So the n standard monomials, yeah. So the fundamental theorem says, you know, you have a polynomial in one variable, you have a polynomial. polynomial in one variable of degree n, it will have n complex solutions. Helmholtz multiplicity. Same thing in many variables. Identical. Example. So here, say we have three equations and three variables, Brown again. So by now, you know how this goes. Let's say we do the pure Lax term order, dictionary order, we calculate the reduced Grobner basis. We look at the leading terms, x squared, xy, xz squared, yz squared, y squared. In this case, the infinitely many standard monomials. So every power of z is standard. So the variety is infinite, the infinitely many solutions. On the other hand, let's replace this y by a 1. Then the Grobner basis comes back like this, x minus stuff, y squared plus stuff, z squared plus stuff. So in that case, there are four standard monomials, 1, y, z, and yz. So there are four solutions to these equations. Okay. Now some of you said, what are the solutions? Well, that we're going to farm out, that we're going to subcontract to the numerical linear algebra department. Based on this blue output, we can now set up matrices in MATLAB, and then we're going to calculate eigenvalues of matrices in MATLAB that give us floating point approximations to both the real and imaginary part of every coordinate of every point in the variety. So this is a pre-processing, a symbolic pre-processing, in this finite case anyways, of a subsequent numerical calculation that takes this green stuff and produces floating point solutions. Okay, well, unfortunately we weren't so lucky with our engineering friend. I'm going to say, your system has infinitely many solutions. What's the next question?
What's the basis for
it? Give me one. Yeah, basis. Remember, this is sort of a wiggly thing, right? It's a surface, you know.
How big is this?
What is the dimension? So it's not a bunch of points. It could be a curve. It could be a surface, you know. Like a statistician would say, how many degrees of freedom do we have, or physicists? Right? Is this 11 dimensional or one dimensional? Mm-hmm. That's typically the next question you would ask. It's not a bunch of points. What's the dimension of this thing? Okay, let me give you a theorem too. So here's the notion of dimension. Well, I'm not going to give you a definition. So let's just think intuitively, you know, points have dimension 1, 0, curves have dimension 1, and so on. Okay, here's the theorem. Take a breath. So S is a subset of the variables. Okay. And I'm going to be interested in the property. So S is a good subset, one that I like. If no monomial in the variables only an S appears in the initial ideal. Let me paraphrase that, so I'm going to say the contrapositive. So S is good, right, if every monomial in only the S variables is standard. S is for standard. And I'm going to look for such a set S of maximal cardinality. Theorem, that's the dimension. So the dimension of the variety is the cardinality of the largest subset of the variables with the property that every monomial in those variables is standard. So that's a combinatorial problem. Yeah, it's NP-hard, I know. But that's a combinatorial problem that Geier can address. You know, given the leading monomials, you know, you can read off, right? What's the largest set S and so on, and that's a number, and that you give back. And then the discussion goes on and on. You know, then there'll be more questions and so on. With only 8.5 minutes left, let me talk a little bit about how you can actually calculate Grobner basis. The software that runs tonight, when you do this tonight, what's actually going on in the computer? Well, let's first ask an easier question. Maybe you don't need to do a calculation at all. Maybe the given equations are already a Grobner basis, right? So the three polynomials walk into the room tonight, and maybe we don't need to compute. Maybe we're lucky. Maybe they're already a Grobner basis. So I want to ask, are you guys a Grobner basis? So how can we test that? Here's how it goes. So Let's do the following. You look at any two of the polynomials, g and g prime, that walk in, and you form the so-called S polynomial. And the S polynomial is the following clever linear combination. It's m prime times g minus m times g prime. And m prime are monomials of the lowest degree, such that they knock out the leading term. And knocking out the leading term means, you know, m prime times the leading term of g equals m times the leading term of g prime. Okay? So you have two polynomials, they have a leading monomial, you want to multiply them, you know, so that the leading terms cancel, and you want to do this in the stingiest possible. Now, where does the term S polynomial come from? Well, the person who came up with this, he was thinking about subtraction. That was Buchbaum. So he called that the subtraction polynomial or the S polynomial. My commutative algebra friends, they think S stands for syzygy. Very nice word. So that's also good. So S could be the syzygy polynomial. I think of S as stingy. So it's the S polynomial, the stingy polynomial. So the S polynomial is the stingiest linear combination that knocks out the leading term. So that's the S polynomial or the stingy polynomial.
So which of these makes sense in German?
Yeah, well, stingy doesn't translate into S. I think syzygy and subtraction probably. Okay, theorem. Okay, so the three polynomials that walked into the room, they were already a Grothendieck basis, if and only if the following criterion holds. I look at any two given polynomials, g and g prime, I form the S polynomial, and then I apply the division algorithm against the set of polynomials. Now, what's the division algorithm? Well, the division algorithm is the coin trading, right? I look at, you know, the terms, are they divisible by the leading terms? If so, replace until you get stuck. Okay, so this coin trading business is called the division algorithm. So you run the division algorithm until you get stuck. Now, there are two possibilities when you get stuck. Either you're at zero, what's left is zero, no remainder, or there's a remainder. And if there is no remainder, if this normal form, the end of the division algorithm, is always zero for any S pair, then you're guaranteed to have a Grothendieck basis. That's a test, finite test, to test whether a given set of polynomials is a Grothendieck basis.
What is the normal form?
The normal form is the following. So I take a polynomial and look at its terms. And I look for each term whether it's a multiple of one of the other leading terms. If yes, you know, substitute in and subtract. And you do this until you get stuck. Okay, now the harder problem. So here's the Buchberger algorithm. So when I teach an algorithm, I often talk about algorithms in my classes, both undergraduate and graduate. And the single most important lesson about teaching algorithms is if you state an algorithm, the first line is the input, and the second line is the output. It's miraculous how that helps. Because most people present algorithms, they don't tell you what's the input, and they say step one, step two, step three. So as I learned in teaching algorithms, the golden rule, the first line is what's the input, the second line is what the output. So here the input is a finite list F of Brown polynomials, and the output is the reduced Grothendieck basis blue G for the ideal, and I guess I should also specify a term order. Okay. So there's a tacit understanding of what the term order is. It's a very simple algorithm. Step one. Are you guys already a Grothendieck basis? Apply the Buchberger test to see whether already we have a Grothendieck basis. If yes, you know, if we succeed, then F is a Grothendieck basis, we go to step four. And then there's a little bit of post-processing. Okay? Post-processing is the order reduction. So then you replace F by the reduced Grothendieck basis. You fix, you know, the make it monic, you know, throw out redundant guys and so on. Okay, and then you output the rest. Well, the only other possibility is it's no, right? So it was not a Grothendieck basis yet. Well, what happened? If it's not a Grothendieck basis yet, then one of these normal forms, P, is not zero. Now that P, by its very construction, is also in the ideal. It's a good new guy in the ideal. You just throw it onto the basis and do it again. You do it again. you go back, you know. Now it looks like there might be an infinite loop, you know, but there actually isn't, you know. There's something called Noetherianity due to Emi Noether that says you don't have a loop, you actually terminate after a while, and what you get out. So this is the basic version of the algorithm. As it's phrased, it's very inefficient, but that's the sort of skeleton of the algorithm. It's called Buchberger's algorithm. So let's see, maybe in an example, how this works. So let's see in one variable, let's discover now, tonight, the Euclidean algorithm. We don't know it yet, but we're about to discover. So here's two polynomials, you know, a Brown quadratic and a Brown cubic. And okay, are you guys already a Grobner basis? Okay, so to test that, we do the S polynomial, the stingiest linear combination. The stingiest thing you can do, here we have an x squared, here we have an x. Well, you can multiply this by x and then subtract that. So the result is 3x squared plus x plus 4. Then we apply the division algorithm. So we look at these monomials. So is any of these guys, you know, divisible by something underlined? Well, yeah, you know, this is divisible by that, so you do it, and then the normal, you know, what's left is minus 8x plus 8. Is that divisible? No, it's not. So it wasn't a Grobner basis. So you throw it in, you know, so therefore f is not a Grobner basis, we large f by adding, and then we do it again, and then next time around we have to, turns out everything goes to zero, and that's a Grobner basis. Now, at this stage, we have this guy, and that guy. Now, the first two we can throw out, no questions asked, because their leading terms are multiples of that leading term. And then we have to divide by the leading coefficient, and the output, the reduced Grobner basis, x minus 1. And that's how the Grobner basis algorithm in one variable works. So in the future, if your students ever ask you, hey, what's the Euclidean algorithm? Just the Buchberger algorithm in one variable. If your students ever ask you, what is Gaussian elimination? It's the Buchberger algorithm for linear polynomials. Okay, so let's wrap it up. Summary, so the Grobner concept of Grobner bases and the Buchberger algorithm for computing them are fundamental in algebra and its many applications. Applications in particular that this has been used include optimization. The coin story was not entirely a joke. People actually use this or certain classes of integer programming problems. Coding theory, robotics, statistics, and computational biology, a subject that I've been very interested in. But also within algebraic geometry. So for computational problems applied to pure questions in algebraic geometry and some examples, you know, elimination theory, computing various cohomology theories, resolution of singularities, okay, in characteristic zero. That's implemented, so resolution of singularities is implemented in a set package called Singular. So here are some names of computer programs. So many, all the standard symbolic computation packages have a Grobner basis implemented, so two very common ones that do everything are Maple and Mathematica. Now, since they do everything, their Grobner implementation is very slow, but it's very good to get started. These things very soon will run on your cell phone, of course. Here are more specialized packages that you can download for free that are more efficient. Macaulay 2, Magma, Cocoa, Singular is one that I like a lot. So I encourage you, if you run into any Brown polynomials tonight, type them in, say Grobner, and take a look at the blue output. Thanks for your attention.
You had early on a theorem about the uniqueness of the reduced Grobner basis. It was stated when you were still back with coefficients in Q.
Yes.
Does the theorem hold for any field of coefficients?
Yes. So this theorem holds. So if this Q is any field, it's true verbatim. There are versions of this. Q doesn't have to be a field. So, for instance, actually, the case where Q is the integers is quite interesting, already rather delicate. So there are versions of this. So Q can be something else. But the more you, the further you get away from Q being a field, the more complicated it gets. In fact, there's Grubner bases exist also. There are various non-commutative versions, you know, for differential operators and all kinds of other settings. But this is the most basic case for which this is true verbatim if it's Q is a field.
Could you give a thumbnail sketch of the history of the evolution of thinking about Grubner bases?
Well, that requires some phylogenetics. So I would say, so Grubner was a classical algebraic geometer. Actually, he was also interested in analysis. He had some very interested to sort of work on differential equations, Lie theory. As the name suggests, Grubner was born in Italy. So he was born between the two world wars in what the Austrians call Südtirol and what the Italians call Alto Adige. So way in the northern part of Italy, the German-speaking part. So he later went to Rome to study. So he was a student of the Italian geometer Severi and so on, and then later on became professor in Innsbruck, which is the capital of Tyrolia. So there's Tyrol, and then there's South Tyrolia, which is Alto Adige. And he worked on these kind of things in the 50s and the 60s, and he basically had a method for doing these kind of calculations. He has a very nice book on sort of ideal theory, you know, still one of the best sources, but he never systematized the method. And Buchberger was his student. He was his PhD student who got the PhD in 1965, and he really sort of gave the criterion and developed the algorithm. So therefore, and you know, Buchberger being a good student, you know, named the concept after his advisor, and others named the algorithm after. Now, it turns out, of course, you know, with any good idea in mathematics, right, with hindsight, somebody else had done it much earlier, especially the French. And so, anyway, the first reference where a concept of a Grubner basis is explicit, but not the algorithm, is actually a paper in 1900 by Paul Gordon. So, those of you who studied the history, so Gordon was the king of invariant theory. Right, in the 19th century, and he was rather unhappy when his field was made obsolete in the other paper. So Hilbert had the 1890 paper, and then the 1893 paper, where Hilbert proved finite generation of the invariant ring with these radically new methods, ideals and so on. And Gordon didn't like that, and Gordon said, well, how can we use, you know, these ideas to actually sort of compute the invariants? And he wrote a paper that's little known in 1900 where he basically had the concept of a Grubner base. And that was really in response to Hilbert's work. And the French did do a lot. So there's a beautiful theory in the 1920s by Riquier and Janet and others on Grubner bases for differential equations. Basically, you have a system of nonlinear PDE, and you want to make the system involute, what's called involute. That's essentially the same. So with hindsight, there are those more sources. But Buchberger came up with the algorithm in his 1965 thesis.
What are the applications to statistics?
So I'm very interested. There's sort of an emerging branch called algebraic statistics. And so there's a book that a bunch of Italians and British statisticians published about 7-8 years ago, and they were interested in experimental design of experiments as the branch of statistics, and they used Grubner bases for that. In the meantime, the field has developed a lot, and we are more interested, you know, in inference, the maximum likelihood estimation, you know, Bayesian inference. So it's a tool that's been used in sort of algebraic inference algorithms for a wide range of models. I have a book, so I like to advertise. We have a book called Algebraic Statistics for Computational Biology. Not very expensive. I can also send you the PDF.
One more question?
These software packages, Are they standalones, these free packages?
Yes. Let's look at them. Actually, I lied a little bit. So Magma is not free.
Yeah.
Magma is definitely not free. It's a very, very good package. It's a package from Australia.
What else
so,
does it do?
So this is not, it can do number theory, group theory. It's a very well implemented package for a wide range of topics. These things are also not free, but these things are standalone. So Macaulay and Single are standalone packages. Cocoa also, although they changed their concept a little bit, the latest version of Cocoa actually supplies C++ code that you can link in. So it used to start out as a sort of computer algebra system. But now the latest version of Cocoa, they provide libraries that you can link in, you know, with other code. And, you know, these things talk to each other. So, for instance, you know, Maple talks to MATLAB. So if you're a MATLAB user and you don't believe in any of this stuff, right? So all you use is MATLAB. And inside MATLAB, there's something called the symbolic toolbox, you know, that you can go out and go to Maple and get your Grobner basis inside MATLAB.
Thank you very much.
These are the